Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup manufactured by Monsanto, parent company Bayer, is widely used in Iowa, sprayed on thousands of acres of farmland each year and commonly used in yards and gardens. Earlier this month, a California jury in a civil trial awarded a couple more than $2 billion in a verdict against Monsanto. The jury ruled that the plaintiffs contracted non-Hodgkin's lymphoma because of their use of Roundup. This is the third such case to end this way in California in the last 2 years. Bayer continues to defend the safety of the product, and it's hard to know what to believe. This hour, we're going to talk about how we use Roundup, what we can learn from these court cases, and what scientific evidence can tell us about the dangers of this and other agricultural chemicals. We also want to hear from you this hour, and I know a lot of people have strong opinions about this. We'll try to share as many of those opinions as possible. You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, tweet at Iowa Public Radio, or call 866-780-9100. And we're going to start with these court cases. Jenny Swagerman is Associate Director of the Drake Agricultural Law Center. She'll become Director of the Center in July, and she is with me now. Hello, Jenny.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And we have heard a lot about these court cases in recent days, in recent months, and in the last 2 years. I want you to help us unpack what these court cases mean, at least in the short term and then hopefully in the long term as well. These are civil court cases. So first of all, tell me why that's such an important distinction to make.
Well, in the civil cases, it's basically plaintiffs who allege an injury just suing the company directly. It's nothing involving the state or county. There's no criminal charges. This is basically just a person against a person or a person against a company in this case, alleging that you caused me harm and therefore I'm deserving of damages.
All right. And we have seen results in 3 cases in California, but there are thousands of cases pending against Monsanto and Bayer, right?
There are. I think last count I saw was something over 13,000 pending across the country. And a recent one filed a class action in Canada as well.
In these civil cases, they are decided by a jury. So tell me a little bit about the process. What is the jury seeing in a case like this to help them make their conclusion?
They're seeing a lot of evidence, a lot of expert witnesses, and they're not short trials. These are averaging at least 3 to 4 weeks per trial. And if you think about the time and the complicated information that the jury is getting, that's part of the reason why. They're going to be getting a lot of information from both sides about glyphosate, about Roundup, about how it's been tested, the safety. It's been regulated for about 44 years now here in the U.S. And so they're getting presented a lot of expert witnesses, a lot of medical witnesses and testimony on the plaintiff's side, basically trying to show that there is danger to using this chemical, particularly if you use it extensively, if you use it over a long period of time and don't take a lot of safety precautions, or even if you do, if something happens. And that because of that, there are risks that increase cancer. In this case, I think most everyone has had some form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, I don't know that all plaintiffs are in that situation. But basically saying there was, the Roundup, not just glyphosate, but it is particularly Roundup in this case that's at issue, caused my cancer.
You mentioned experts on both sides. So the scientific experts that are presenting evidence to the jury are not supposed to be impartial. They are hired by the two different sides in the case, right?
Correct. They are supposed to be impartial in the sense that they're ideally going to be looking at all of the evidence with an impartial mindset. They're not coming in with some sort of particular idea about how they should read the science. But at the same time, you aren't going to, on either side, going to hire and pay an expert witness that doesn't agree with your position in the case. So in that sense, they are going to be supporting their party's position. But the goal is that they are looking at all of the evidence, which in this case is extremely extensive, over 44 years, with that open mind to try and fairly analyze the risks, the reliability, or the likelihood that this type of disease was caused by Roundup.
Now, in just a moment, we're going to bring Iowa Public Radio reporter Grant Gerlach into the conversation, and then in a little while, Dr. Charles Lynch as well, to help us understand the science that is out there right now. But the science that is being presented at these trials, Jenny, it's scientific research that should be available to the public?
Yes and no. The information that EPA uses, in fact, there is a whole host of that. They have their own glyphosate page on the EPA Environmental Protection Agency website. And a lot of that information is publicly available. In fact, you know, you can comment on their proposed regulations and restrictions right now about their reauthorization for the use of glyphosate. But at the same time, Monsanto's information, now Bayer's, but Monsanto's at the time, a lot of that wasn't made public. They have, largely in response to these lawsuits, started to make some of those scientific studies public now and releasing some of those to the public. But that's not always the case. And it's not just Monsanto's research that is being used by EPA and by Monsanto. They do have other academic institutions or government institutions across the world that are conducting research as well.
The awards given by juries in these cases, of course, are grabbing incredible headlines, $2 billion for two individuals in this most recent case. But that's not necessarily the end of this process, right?
Oh, no. I think we will see this going on for at least several more years just with these three cases in particular. You saw this in the first case that damages were already reduced. There are limits on the punitive damages in particular. And so while each of the plaintiffs in that third case were awarded $1 billion each, the requirements under law will reduce that naturally. But aside from that, in the first case, briefs, I believe, have already been filed in the appeal. The first case, the plaintiff is so ill, they've granted a speedy schedule to try and get this appeal done while he is still alive and able to participate. And so we may see arguments on that first appeal at the California Court of Appeals yet this year, if not early next year. But that process is moving forward. And Bayer has indicated that with these other two decisions, the other two cases, one in federal court, one in state court, that they will be appealing those as well.
And when those appeals are made, the process is different. This is not going to be a decision decided by a jury.
Absolutely. This is going to go before a panel of judges, no jury. Excuse me. And the judges are going to be looking at basically the evidence that was before the jury and determining if they made a decision that was fair and supported by the evidence. And so they're not going to be relooking and retrying the case at the appellate level. Instead, they're going to be looking at what the law says is required, what the standard is that the jury had to meet, and did the evidence support it? It's not whether or not we necessarily agree with the jury, but whether or not there was evidence to support what the jury found.
And just to draw a distinction again, in a civil court case, is the burden of proof different from that of a criminal court case?
The burden here is on the plaintiff. The plaintiff has to prove, in this case in particular, that their illness, their injury, was in fact caused by Roundup, or at least that the Roundup and their use of it, their exposure to it, was a substantial factor in causing the injury or the illness. And that is different. I mean, even different criminal cases, different civil cases will have different burdens of proof. But it is on the plaintiff in this case to prove not only that Roundup can cause this harm, but that in this particular case, it caused that harm.
All of these cases have taken place in California. Is that significant moving forward for Monsanto and Bayer?
I think yes and no. The next scheduled case to go to trial is actually in St. Louis County, which will be later this summer. The next two, I believe, are scheduled to go to trial in St. Louis County in August and September. And that's the home of Monsanto. So that could be interesting to see what happens there, even though those are generally seen as fairly plaintiff-friendly jurisdictions when it comes to these types of cases. I think Bayer is hopeful and really counting on the fact that appellate review, no matter where they are, is going to really make a difference. But, you know, this is the two in particular that are California law will apply to California cases. But these are class actions. I think what it means more is that the more cases we have that are found in plaintiff's favor, the more pressure there is going to be, particularly by Bayer's investors and shareholders, to try and make these go away and get settlements.
Now, of course, we have to wait and see what happens with these cases over time. We're going to talk more about the science in just a moment. But also, a lot of decisions get made in the court of public opinion. And a lot of people are really upset to hear about what's going on. So what do you feel the impact of these cases is on Monsanto, on Bayer, on individuals already?
I think we're seeing it come out in a couple of ways. One, there was already sort of this distrust by a lot of the consuming public of big agriculture, Monsanto in particular, and this certainly isn't helping. And a lot of the documents that have come out through some of these cases definitely are not helping that either in terms of the court of public opinion and some of the things that Monsanto was saying and doing through emails and other types of studies and work with reporters. But, you know, it really is going to make an impact on what consumers are going to start to think about other chemicals in general and their use. And is this going to impact their decisions on what they use at home, the foods that they buy and the pressures they're going to see there? And it really underlies the importance of, again, of having an understanding of what this means in terms of science outside of major agricultural use to the home consumer as well and to the food we eat.
Jennifer Zwagerman, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jennifer Zwagerman is Associate Director of the Drake Agricultural Law Center. She'll be director coming in July. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events, including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Roundup. Glyphosate, of course, is the active ingredient in Roundup manufactured by Monsanto. Their parent company is Bayer. It is widely used in Iowa in farming and, of course, in yards and gardens as well. Earlier this month, a California jury in a civil trial awarded a couple more than $2 billion in a verdict against Monsanto and Bayer, ruling that the plaintiffs contracted non-Hodgkin's lymphoma because of their use of Roundup. This is the third such case. This hour, we're talking about how we use Roundup, what the research can tell us about this chemical and other agricultural chemicals as well, and also how it's changing people's views of Roundup. We'd love to hear from you. Has this changed your mind about Roundup in any way? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. With me right now is Iowa Public Radio reporter Grant Gerlach. He has been reporting on agriculture and Roundup for a number of years. Grant, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And I want to start with sort of a Roundup 101 with you, because as I mentioned, it's very common in yards and gardens, so a lot of Iowans have encountered it, but Iowans who don't work in agriculture may not understand how Roundup is used on a large scale in agriculture. So I know that it was introduced in the 1970s, but it got to be really, really commonly used in the late 90s. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was when the first glyphosate-resistant or Roundup-resistant crops were deregulated and then introduced into the agriculture industry, first soybeans and then corn. And what that means is that farmers could use glyphosate and Roundup differently. So I'll try to explain this. When Roundup first came out, it was used as a pre-emergent herbicide. Farmers would use it before they plant or before their crops come up, because if you had sprayed it on the plants then, it would have killed everything, the crops, the weeds, everything. The resistant crops, you can spray it over the top of the crops and it kills the weeds, but not the beans, not the corn. And so it became a really valuable tool, because instead of using the pre-emergent herbicides, that way you could use it during the season and have better weed control in your fields. So it became very widespread. Those crops are now more than 90% of the crops that are planted are herbicide resistant.
And this was a real game changer for farmers. I mean, it has increased yields dramatically. It's really changed how a lot of farmers do what they do.
Well, it's definitely changed how farmers do what they do. Has it increased yields dramatically? That's a little more of an open question.
Okay.
It has contributed to increased yields, but that trait itself, the weed-resistant trait, may not be as responsible for increased yields as much as just improved genetics and those other traits that improve the production of corn and soybeans.
So when it's applied in the springtime, just give me an idea of how it's done and how often. How many acres are we spraying with Roundup?
Well, just about all of them, the majority. So, for instance, when it comes to corn and soybeans in Iowa, let's see here. I'm just pulling up my notes here. In Iowa, we used 9 million pounds of glyphosate on corn in 2018 and 9.16 million pounds on soybeans. It was the most common pesticide used, although on corn there are some others that are common, like atrazine. The one thing that I thought was interesting was that the amount used per acre has increased since glyphosate was in its early days. So, for instance, since 2002, it's increased a fair amount. So there's more glyphosate being used per acre than it used to be. And so it's really just a very common tool. Basically, you see the big sprayers that cross the fields back and forth. There's a concentrated Roundup chemical that's mixed with water, and that's what you see them spraying on the fields.
All right. Now, there have been concerns about safety for years as well, and we've gotten conflicting research on that. So let's take a look at a little bit of what we do know, or what we think we know, about Roundup. We know that last year, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, a panel of scientists assembled by the World Health Organization, determined that glyphosate probably can cause cancer. But that's not quite as definitive as it sounds. So explain that research to me.
Right. So this is a few years ago. IARC, as it's called, is an agency within the World Health Organization. And what they do is every so often they'll get together groups of scientists who work on a particular chemical or exposure to decide whether it could cause cancer. And they've done this for hundreds of different kinds of chemicals and even things that aren't chemicals, like red meat, or working in a barbershop. So they do some arcane types of things, and then they do some sort of basic chemicals. Glyphosate was one of them. And so what they do is they recruit scientists from around the world who have either worked on science related to this area or worked on science related to the chemical, and they'll sort them into different committees. There are people who've worked on epidemiological studies, you know, population studies, people who've worked on animal models, and then people who have worked on laboratory experiments looking at cell function. And they'll have them all look at the available science, decide which science is most relevant to the question, and then basically they vote whether it's whether the evidence available weighs toward it could cause cancer or it does cause cancer. And they've got this range of possibilities. Number one is this causes cancer. This is straight out a carcinogen. Glyphosate is not in that category. It's in category 2A, which is probable carcinogen, which means there are some traits there that suggest that it could cause cancer, but it's not as straightforward as it's a carcinogen just straight out. So it leaves a little more of a question there. And there are some reasons for that. Should I go into that?
Yeah, a little bit, briefly. And we have so much to talk about.
I know. So And part of it's the difference between these different kinds of science. If you look at how glyphosate works on cells in a petri dish, it shows some damage. If you look at how it works on animals at high doses, it can show some possibilities of causing cancer. And then in the epidemiological studies, there were some suggestions it could be related to that too. And so they decided it did cause cancer, but other agencies have looked at that same evidence. Sometimes they add a little more or a little less on those different categories, and they come to different conclusions.
All right. And we do know that the EPA announced last month the reauthorization of glyphosate. The USDA, of course, has said that this is essential. What do you make of that? It really feels like we're getting contradictory reports.
Yeah. And that's because there is some debate about one part of the debate is it glyphosate that causes cancer or is it the chemicals that go with glyphosate? So when we talk about Roundup, that's glyphosate is the active ingredient, but there are other chemicals in there that go with it that make the glyphosate more effective. Those are called adjuvants. And there are some studies that suggest that when those are sort of part of the mix, that it is more harmful than just glyphosate on its own. And so there's just some distinction there about, are we really talking about glyphosate alone, or are we talking about glyphosate in concert with these other substances? And, you know, I think that's kind of an interesting question because in the real world, people are probably using some kind of mix. So is it better to look at it isolated, or is it better to look at it in its context that it would be in the environment?
All right. I want to introduce another guest here in just a moment, but I also, a lot of people have a lot to say about this. You're welcome to join our conversation, 866-780-9100. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Bob is on the line in Bettendorf. Bob, briefly, what would you like to talk about?
Yes, I just wanted to make sure one study was mentioned. It's from the Journal of National Cancer Institute, Oxford University, and they went through, it's a gold standard study, they went through, it says here, 54,250 professional applicators, and they came to this conclusion. And this study, by the way, was sponsored by, among others, University of Iowa. It wasn't sponsored by Bayer. It wasn't sponsored by Monsanto. And they came to the conclusion that in this large prospective cohort study, no association was apparent between glyphosate and any solid tumors or lymphoid malignancies overall, including NHL and its subtype. There was some evidence of increase of AML, although statistically among the highest exposed groups, and it requires a confirmation.
Okay.
Like I say, this was a huge gold standard study, and you never hear about it.
Well, actually, we have a person who is involved in that research here in just a moment. Bob, thanks for bringing that up. Of course, we also want to hear from other viewpoints as well. This is an email from Margaret. She says, I'm amazed that with it being common knowledge that the Midwest is, quote, a hotbed of cancer, that we are slow to see the elephant in the room. Our yards, fields, everywhere, it's sprayed, and people do not follow the directions for safety. I'm always appalled at the scientists from Iowa State University who routinely advise Roundup for common use on garden programs and never mention the dangers. So obviously there are some very strong feelings about that. I do want to bring Dr. Charles Lynch into the conversation now. He's professor and medical director of the State Health Registry of Iowa and the Iowa Cancer Registry. He was the Iowa director of the Agricultural Health Study for its first 25 years. Dr. Lynch, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. And Bob introduced a little bit of your research there. So tell me a little bit about the research study that you've been a part of, which is not just focused on glyphosate, but on 50 different herbicides and pesticides, right?
Yes. Our study is called the Agricultural Health Study, and it involves over 58,000 primarily farmers and farmers' wives here in Iowa, as well as a similar group of people in the state of North Carolina. And in total, we have nearly 90,000 participants in the study. They were enrolled between 1993 and 1997, and we've been following them for their primarily their chronic disease experiences ever since. And this study will continue for the next few decades as well, because only about 20% of the cohort has died thus far. So there's 80% alive to develop health events, which we are monitoring.
So as you look at this information that you've gathered over time, of course, it's not a controlled experiment because these are real people engaging in real activities living in the world. But what kinds of trends can we see thus far?
Well, I just wanted to point out, this is, as you said, an observational study. So what we're doing is enrolling people and having them report to us about their use of pesticides. Farmers are pretty good group in terms of recalling their use of pesticides because they pay money for it. And they're also part of a certification training program in the states of Iowa and North Carolina where they are obliged to sort of track what pesticides they're using. So we feel we get pretty accurate information from them. Another important part about the design of our study is that it's called a prospective cohort study. And by that, I mean we are collecting data on the exposures that these people have had before they ever developed the disease. So the other common type of observational study in which hypotheses are tested is the case control study design, in which you start with people with the disease and people without the disease. Those with the disease are called cases. Those without are called controls. You then go back and collect information from them about their exposures. It's a different type of design. Felt in agriculture to have a problem with agricultural exposures of recall bias. That is, the people who have the disease are going to be thinking more and more about why they developed that disease, and they will tend to report more agricultural exposures than would the control who has not developed the disease, may still be a farmer but hasn't developed any disease. And I kind of agree with that. That type of error is called recall bias. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's occurring in every study, but there's a potential for it. In our prospective cohort study, we get around that by collecting the information on exposure before anyone has developed the disease. We're following them for the development of their disease. So the previous caller had talked about our 2018 publication study, and the reason it probably hasn't gotten as much publicity is a lot of the people have been reacting to the IARC report, and that utilized existing published data, and that report came out in 2015. So our most recent report in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute was not available for review at that time. But we did have a study included in that IARC review from 2005 that also looked at non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and we did not find an association with glyphosate in that particular report. But we did see an association with multiple myeloma, which is another type of lymphoma. But as it turned out in the 2018 report, we no longer saw that association with multiple myeloma. So what I'm trying to point out is there's probably a continued need scientifically to look at the health effects of pesticides and, in the case of our discussion here today, to continue to look at the health effects in humans of glyphosate as well.
So, Dr. Lynch, I realize this is an ongoing study, but when you hear about these court cases and the findings of the juries that say that glyphosate Roundup has caused non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, what's your reaction?
Well, my reaction is that these types of things can happen, essentially. The science is... science of in epidemiology, particularly observational epidemiology, is we're typically looking for evidence of consistency across studies, and we're not necessarily seeing that. But then you could raise the question, why did IARC make the decision that they made? And as was pointed out by our previous speaker, they don't look just at human studies. They also look at animal and mechanistic studies as well. And it was pointed out in their decision that they were making it more on the animal and mechanistic study findings than they were on the epidemiologic study findings.
If you were a farmer, how would you feel about this product?
Well, I'm not a farmer, but I grew up and spent many summers on my grandfather's farm. And my sense is in the farming community that they feel this is important. But what I also find is that when they develop a chronic disease like cancer, one of the first things that they think could have contributed to that are the exposures that they had in agriculture, and pesticides is pretty high on that list.
Right.
So people who develop cancer in the farming environment, I think, generally have concerns about their past use of pesticides. But only a small proportion of all people develop cancer. I shouldn't say a small proportion. It's a fairly high proportion who develop any type of cancer. But in the process of doing that,
Dr. Lynch, we are out of time, but thank you so much for talking with me today, Dr. Charles Lynch. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup, which, of course, is manufactured by Monsanto. Monsanto is now owned by Bayer. And Iowa Public Radio reporter Grant Gerlach is still with us. He'll come back into the conversation here in just a moment. And I want to mention again that Dr. Charles Lynch, who I was just speaking to, is a professor and medical director of the State Health Registry of Iowa and the Iowa Cancer Registry. He was the Iowa director of the Agricultural Health Study for its first 25 years. Now, of course, farmers are the ones who interact with Roundup the most. It is a tool used by the vast majority of conventional farmers in Iowa on a large scale, and we wanted to hear from farmers this hour. So Iowa Public Radio producer Emily Woodbury spoke with Doug Adams of Humboldt, Mitchell Hora of Washington, and Bruce Rower of Paulina.
So I'm Doug Adams. I farm up in north central Iowa in southwest Humboldt County and northern Webster County, where we grow corn and soybeans. And I also work as a technician at the NRCS office here in Humboldt.
And how did Roundup sort of change the game as far as kind of farming techniques?
So, yeah, in the late 90s, mid to late 90s, when Roundup-ready crops were introduced, it went from being just a spot treatment type herbicide. We would actually ride a bean bar across the fields and just shoot the plants with glyphosate whenever, we would find those weeds that escaped the normal herbicide program. And so it would just be a spot treatment type herbicide. And then in the 90s, we started using the genetically modified crops that were bred to be resistant to the Roundup, and that allowed us to spray Roundup broadcast over the fields. And that really worked well for quite a few years, but lately we've started seeing some resistance. And so for that, I've been using more cover crops to help put a mulch down on the soil that helps prevent some of those resistant weeds from even germinating.
I am Bruce Rohr, a family farmer in northwest Iowa, farming starting in 1975 with my father, and farm today with my son and daughter.
Describe your response to the court cases recently where juries found Roundup used to be the cause of the plaintiff's cancer diagnosis.
I have not seen anything come from these cases that would make me question the scientific findings that these different agencies have found over the years. This is unfortunate. Roundup has facilitated more conservation practices in the growing of crops because of its effectiveness and its being safe to use. Before we had Roundup, we relied upon tillage for weed control in our crops. And with the use of Roundup, we were able to do less tillage, which means our farming practices are more sustainable because we have less of our soil at risk of erosion, which is all because of the ability of Roundup to control weeds without having to disturb the soil.
My name is Mitchell Hora. I'm a farmer down in Washington County, and I'm the founder and CEO of Continuum Ag. my initial response on it is, okay, it's pretty far shot, I think, to be able to tie a lot of these things together. There's so many things in this world that are possible carcinogens and whatnot. We're surrounded by it all the time. I don't know. You know, I don't know. Maybe there is some roundabout ties and whatnot, but my response is, you know, if it is directly causing cancer, there should be a heck of a lot more people here in the Corn Belt, you know, that are dying at super young ages from being exposed to it and handling it all the time like we do out on the farm.
You know, I've looked at we read the label on our products. The label's listed as a caution, so it means you need to pay attention to what's on the label, but caution is the lowest level of hazard, I guess, the label on a herbicide label. We've got caution, warning, and danger. And so, you know, we respect all herbicides that we use, and we use the proper protective equipment. And when I look at the court cases out in California, I just think maybe it's more of a political type climate out there. They've got something against the chemical company and have found people on the jury that have sided with the plaintiffs and stuff.
So it sounds like you're not too worried about the impact on your own health. Is that a good characterization?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of different organizations that look at the herbicides when they're, you know, presented to be sold to the public. You got the EPA looks at it, the World Health Association also looks at it. So I feel that, you know, they've done a lot of the research. I think it's fair, unbiased research. And so I take their, you know, word for it and just follow the label and use it as directed. I think it's a safe product. Breaks down pretty rapidly in the environment. Really doesn't stand out in the environment for a long time like some of our other herbicides that we may use. And so I like to be able to use ones that are safest for the environment and effective too.
We're reducing our glyphosate use for sure. We're trying other things. We're trying to get away from it, but it boils down to an economic system and utilizing something that works. I mean, it's definitely no secret that there's a heck of a lot of weeds out here in our fields in Iowa. We are trying to reduce those populations by utilizing cover crops, reducing tillage, changing up rotations a little bit if we can, and trying some other chemical herbicides as well. Now, some of those alternative herbicides are pretty nasty stuff too, that directly for the handler can actually, you know, directly cause some different health concerns and whatnot. So, and some of those products take a lot more water. They're a lot more costly. They don't work near as effectively. So, although we are, you know, definitely we're reducing our usage by a lot. We definitely are. A lot of my farmers that I'm working with are definitely reducing their usage by a lot. I think we're going to keep seeing that happen, but it's going to be a work in progress that we can't quite just pull the carpet out from the entire industry here anytime real soon.
We were listening to the voices of three different farmers there. Iowa Public Radio producer Emily Woodbury spoke with Doug Adams of Humboldt, Mitchell Hora of Washington, and Bruce Rohr of Paulina. Iowa Public Radio reporter Grant Gerlach is still with us. And Grant, I mean, listening to the voices of those farmers, is that basically what you're hearing from people in ag?
I would say those are, that's a good range of perspectives that would capture a lot of what I would hear and would expect to hear from farmers on the ground. It's glyphosate is still a critical tool in their weed control systems. As you mentioned, you heard about some of the alternatives that can change where glyphosate fits in that system with cover crops or different rotations. And it just depends on the farmer where they're at in terms of shifting how they use the chemicals and those other tools within their farm.
Of course, in addition to concerns about health effects possibly of using Roundup, we are also seeing the development of Roundup-resistant weeds. So when farmers are talking about looking for alternatives, of course, they've been looking because of that as well. But, I mean, is there a viable – do farmers feel like there's a viable direction to go in if they're not using Roundup?
Well, the direction was supposed to be dicamba, but that sort of raised its own issues. There are not, like, there's no silver bullet on the horizon for, there's no new Roundup that's in the works that's going to be the next just all-around tool that they can use. So that's part of where the motivation comes from, to try to mix up what's in the toolbox to integrate those cover crops and other things, because the chemistry just isn't keeping up with the weeds in this case.
I want to bring another voice into this conversation. We've been talking about how we use Roundup. Of course, it is a commonly used herbicide in the state of Iowa. We've talked about how the herbicide is used in agriculture, health concerns. And yesterday I checked in with Bob Hartzler. He's a professor of agronomy at Iowa State University and a weed specialist at Iowa State University Extension. I asked him about his response to these civil court cases.
Well, I tell students in my class I'm not trained as a toxicologist, and so I try to stay out of the debate. I like to trust our regulatory agencies to make a good decision. I think any time we use a pesticide or any synthetic compound, we have to be concerned about it. When I've looked at the decisions made by not only regulatory agencies, but also various scientific organizations, I am comfortable that glyphosate, when used appropriately, should not pose a threat for cancer or other issues. But that doesn't mean we should just use it carelessly. I am comfortable with how it's being used, I guess.
As I mentioned, and as you know, I mean, there are a lot of people who are really concerned about our usage of Roundup in this state. I host Horticulture Day on Fridays here on Talk of Iowa, and I get a lot of complaints from listeners when glyphosate is mentioned as an option. And I do want to just say that I understand that the role of Iowa State University Extension is to represent the options to people, not to advocate for something. And so when Richard Geron and other experts on the program offer that as an option, it's in response to a question. And almost without fail, there's also an organic option mentioned at the same time. And Richard Geron in particular is always very careful in talking about application of Roundup in a very pointed way, using a foam brush to paint it on the surface of a cut stem, something like that. But beyond that, the thing that I hear most from people who are worried about it is that they say, well, Bayer Monsanto, the company that manufactures Roundup, is a large supporter of Iowa State University. So they feel like employees from Iowa State University would be pressured not to say anything critical about this product. I'm sure you've heard that as well. What is your reaction to that?
Yeah, and I can understand that. And it is a valid concern. In my case, I would hope people would look at the positions I've taken over the years and feel that I have, in cases where I think there are risks associated with compounds, I would be very straightforward in addressing those risks. Again, I prefer to stick in my area of expertise, and that is, you know, how we use the products and the risks to the adjacent environment. And so if we look at the dicamba situation, I feel Iowa State University has been very straightforward in saying that we feel there are significant issues with this technology and that there should be further restrictions. And that is another Monsanto/Bayer product. And so that is a situation where we have been very straightforward, much to the discontent of industry. Yes, we do accept money. It allows us to evaluate the products and provide recommendations on how best to use them, but I don't think it influences how we view the risks associated with those products.
There are a lot of people who are concerned that, again, with the money involved with a large corporation like Bayer and Monsanto, that their influence actually stands in the way of researchers thoroughly exploring the risks, thoroughly studying the risks of a product like Roundup, because it's difficult to get funding for that kind of research. How do you feel about that?
Yes, I mean, obviously, you know, the manufacturers are not going to provide funding for you to try to find flaws with their products. And so that's where we have to go to outside agencies to find that type of funding. Usually the USDA would be the biggest supporter of, you know, agricultural research. And that is usually not their top priority. So it is very difficult trying to find funding for that type of research. But again, I hate to use the dicamba scenario, university researchers across the region where the dicamba-resistant crops have been planted have found resources to investigate the off-target movement and see what can be done to minimize those risks when, you know, the EPA doesn't seem to be taking the steps that we feel would be appropriate.
Bob Hartzler, thank you so much for your time today.
Enjoyed it.
Bob Hartzler is a professor of agronomy at Iowa State University and a weed specialist at Iowa State University Extension. Iowa Public Radio reporter Grant Gerlach is still here with me. And Grant, of course, you heard me ask Bob that big question about monetary influence at Iowa State University, other research universities. We also got this email from Dirk in Iowa City who says, how much money do our state research universities take from Monsanto and their big ag customers? From your perspective as an agricultural reporter, do you feel like impartial research is possible in this environment?
Yes, but it does matter where the money comes from. You know, because that informs the questions that are being asked. So if you want impartial questions, you need some impartial money there. And that has been an issue with the level of public funding for university research. And that's really across the board. That's not just Iowa State, that's nationwide. And plant science groups have been calling for more research money in agriculture from federal sources, which you would assume might bring on some of those more impartial questions. And that is coming a little bit. Like, for instance, the most recent farm bill increased research funding a little bit, but it's not where they would like to see it.
All right. Well, we will keep an eye on this. There are many, many more court cases to come in the near future, right, Grant?
No doubt. No doubt.
All right. Iowa Public Radio reporter Grant Gerlach, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
We've been talking about glyphosate this hour, brand name Roundup, commonly used herbicide in the state of Iowa and around the world. And of course, it's been a high profile player in recent court cases in the state of California. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Dennis Reese. We had production assistance today from Stephanie Nobringa and John Pemble.